Tonight again, we appreciate your presence and encouragement, and we turn again to the Epistle to the Hebrews and chapter 12 for our reading tonight. Hebrews and chapter 12. I read selections from the whole chapter commencing at verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your mind. Verse 5, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Verse 9, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much more rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Verse 12, wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, looking diligently lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For ye know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. For ye are not come unto the mount that might be touched. Then we have a description of Mount Sinai, verse 22. But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, the general assembly, and the church of the firstborn which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling, that speaketh better things than that of Abel. See that ye refuse not him that speaketh, for if they escaped not who refused him that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven. Whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us of grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably, with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. We trust the Lord will bless his word. As we all know, it's a very extensive chapter, and it will not be possible to go through every detail, but as I mentioned on previous nights, and for those who have been here, I think the picture will begin to take shape that we are seeking to examine from these concluding four chapters of the Epistle to the Hebrews, a portrait of the believer and the life that brings pleasure to God. We have already had two particular ingredients of that life. You will remember, those who were able to be here on Monday evening, that we examined the references to pleasure in chapter 10, and we were discovering from that chapter that there were sacrifices which brought God no pleasure, but then there was a perfect sacrifice which afforded him eternal delight. And we considered on Monday evening that the life of the Lord Jesus was the pattern of a life that pleases God. And the first ingredient of a God-pleasing life is total consecration. The offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Everything upon the altar for God, total consecration. We spent some time last night looking at the principle of life as it stamped across Hebrews chapter 11. And we discovered the second feature of a life that is pleasurable to God. It's a life of consistency. And we were particularly impressed with just that simple statement concerning Enoch. He had this testimony that he pleased God. And we thought about the steady plod and the steady pace of that life, which for 300 years in the world of Cain, he moved along keeping pace with God, walked with God, until eventually that walk climaxed in the paradise above. So the first mark is a consecrated life. That pleases God. The second mark is a consistent life, just steadily going on. That pleases God. And what I want to consider tonight from chapter 12, the feature that will be before us, is a controlled life. So that as we take a look at some of the paragraphs in this particular chapter, we will be examining a number of controls that exert their influence in the Christian life. And as the believer responds to those challenges and to those controls, he will be living a life that will please the God who has saved them. Now, as I pointed out on a previous occasion, in our English translation here, there is no specific reference to pleasing God in this chapter. However, it is concealed toward the end of the chapter. In verse number 28, we read the words, "We receive in a kingdom which cannot be moved. Let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably, with reverence and godly fear." Now, that little adverb, acceptably, it's only here the adverb occurs, but it's exactly the corresponding adverb to well pleased. Our God was pleased, had this testimony that he pleased God. And we'll discover it again in the next chapter. I'm a little uncomfortable with the translation. Sometimes the word is translated acceptable, and sometimes it's translated accepted. Now, that can be very, very misleading and can give the wrong impression. You may remember back in your school days when you did a piece of work and you handed it into the teacher and he looked at it and furrowed his brow and hesitated for about 15 seconds and gave his shoulders a bit of a shrug and, well, it's not just what I wanted, but it'll do. It's not just right, but well, it'll be acceptable. Acceptable. And if we have any of that flavor in our minds when we're reading this word, we're off the mark. When the Bible speaks, for example, in Romans chapter 12, that good and acceptable and perfect will of God, it doesn't mean that it's something that God, well, I'll accept it. I would like better, but I'll put up with it. I'll tell it, it'll be acceptable. No. The far better translation is, as the word is translated in Philippians chapter 4, where the Apostle Paul speaking about the gift that the Philippians have, and he tells them that it's an offering of sweet-smelling savour, well-pleasing. Well-pleasing. It's not just something that God tolerates. This word indicates something that God appreciates and delights in. The most serious mistranslation, of course, of this particular word is 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And in that chapter, the Apostle Paul says that he labours, or he gives his very best, or he's diligently ambitious, that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. Now, that's a very misleading translation. The Apostle Paul was not labouring to be accepted, and neither am I. If my acceptance with God depended on my labour, I would be lost forever. We are already accepted in the Beloved One. That is a positional standing with which our labours
had nothing to do. The Apostle Paul was not laboring to be accepted of him. He already had that blessing, but he was ambitious that he might be well pleasing to him. So that's the word. We have it here in chapter 12, and the acceptable life. Let us have grace whereby we may serve God in a manner that is well pleasing with reverence and godly fear. And as I've already said, in the chapter we have a number of controls that will guarantee such a life will actually take place. Now, I'm not given to quotations from C.S. Lewis, but sometimes when I'm stuck, I will resort to such assistance. I have great doubts about the man, not least the fact that he was a parish man, but that's only the first negativity, and there are others that follow after that. Nevertheless, he did say something that I think is worth thinking about. He said, "The God whom we serve is very easy to please, but he's very hard to satisfy." He's easy to please, but he's very hard to satisfy. The feeblest sincere attempt of a devout believer pleases him. But when that attempt is over, he's looking for something greater. He's looking for something more. He's looking for something higher. God, the God of the Bible, said he, is very easy to please, but he's very hard to satisfy. To illustrate what he was saying, he drew the analogy of the father with a little boy. And the little boy is 2 years old or whatever, and he takes his first wobbly steps, and he just makes about the distance of the aisle here from one chair to another, and very, very unsteady. But just though, and the father is absolutely pleased to pieces to see the first steps of his 2-year-old son, and he thinks it's just great, and everybody in the house stops talking just because they want to. But then 18 years later, what so pleased the father in 1980, if that's still the only walking that boy can do in 1998, his father will not be satisfied. 18 years later, the daddy that was so pleased with those wobbly steps, he'll expect to have a grown son that can stand on his own feet and can stride out with fatherly likeness. And he's always looking for more. Now, he was pleased. Oh, he was pleased. He was pleased with that commencement, but he wasn't satisfied. So that the God whom we serve, when I got saved in 1970, and I first began to pray, first began to worship, and first began to tithe and give a little contribution to the service of God, the God who saved me, he was delighted. But he wasn't satisfied with that. There's no complacency. There's no stagnation. So that we want to be always going on. And part of that development process is what is before us here in Hebrews chapter 12. I think Lewis maybe also used the analogy, because I have read some of his books, believe it or not. But he also used the analogy that when God saved them, and I hope he did, Lewis would have been very, very happy if God had made him into a nice little cottage. Now, he said it was a bit of a shack. He said, when God saved me, it was a shack. The little building of my life was in ruin. And he said, changes took place. And he put in new windows, put in a new central heating system. You had the same change, hadn't you? You remember when God saved us and the new light got in. And there was new warmth. that we never had before, and he ignited a fire of holy devotion within our souls. And Lewis said that he thought when God first started to change, take this little shack, that he would, if he made it into a summer cottage, just a nice wee roof on it, fairly comfortable. But he said he wasn't too long saved until God knocked the side wall in. And then he knocked the back wall. And then he said he took the roof off. And one tragedy after another came crashing into Lewis's life, and the whole business began to be reconfigured. And he said, it took me a while to just come to terms with the fact that God was not intending to make me into a nice little summer cottage where he would come for 2 weeks every summer. He said God was going to make me into a palace where he would dwell forever. And he said he was trying to make the rooms bigger. And he was trying to lift the roof higher. And he said he put up a great big sign, major renovations. No, he said, I didn't like the disturbance. He said, I would have been content just to have all the work done within about 2 months and everything just left reasonably respectable. But he said, God wanted things. He had far bigger ideas. And there's, you know, maybe there's a Christian here tonight and the back wall's out of your house. And maybe half the roof's been lifted off. You know what God might have decided to do with you? He might have thought that you have such capacity that he's going to add on another story. And he can't put the other story on without lifting up the roof. Now it's very disturbing. And there's an awful lot of dust. And there are broken pieces of things. You know what you folks did with this hall here? When you started out, I don't know what you were going to do, but just a little bit. And then when you scrape back and look at the polish you've made for the next best thing. You've made a real job of it, but you couldn't do that without an awful lot of dust and dirt and pieces. And you're right, you say there are broken pieces every... What is God doing? Well, he knows what he's doing. He hasn't lost control. I hope that you haven't lost confidence, because your trust in him will guarantee that the renovation work will take place sooner rather than later. And if you don't trust him too well, he'll maybe have to knock another wall down just to make the thing all work out. But we'll see the development in some of this chapter that produce a controlled life of reverence, godly fear, of service that will be well pleasing to him. Now, the first thing in the first paragraph, it's exceedingly well known, and I may not spend too much time talking about it, but it's a precious paragraph. The first thing to recognize, if a Christian is going to please God, he will have to recognize this, that there's a race that has to be run. Now, I'll be going through in a very sketchy way, I want to go through the paragraphs of the chapter and to highlight a main point in each little paragraph, and then from that main point a specific thought. And the first main point is this: there's a race that has to be run. Now he says, let us run with patience. That's our operative word here. Or let us run with steadfastness. Or, if you like, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Now, the Christian race, I think all of us who have been any length of time on the way, we will be very ready to admit that the race is not easy. One little comfort we have, I was thanking the Lord for the day in the little room over there. The race may not be easy, but it's a great mercy that we're in it. You know, we used to be racing on the road to hell, on the fast track to eternal ruin. We're grateful for the grace that took our feet from the road of doom and put us into the Christian race. It has been difficult and it has been demanding. And at times it seems as if for many a believer, the odds are stacked against them and against her. The odds against making progress are heaven. And so the writer says to these believers who were having their own problems, he says, now the big thing in this race is to keep at it. And don't quit. I remember one time I was in America and I saw a big sign up at a stadium. You know the way they talk about things. It said, winners are never quitters. And quitters are never winners. That's part of the thought here in Hebrews chapter 12. Let us run with stickability. Now, it's not run with speed. This is not the sprint. This is not the 100 meters thing. The speed in this particular race is not the main thing. It's just let us run with steadfastness. You know, I was telling them across there a few nights ago, when I was a younger believer, I used to look upon some of these older Christians and I thought they were old dozers, some of them. You know, they couldn't find a place very quickly. And there were times they were trying to code a verse and they couldn't code it. And they didn't get things done. And they were there at all the meetings and I used to think they were, well, just using excessive oxygen, to say the very least. And they needed to be pushed out of the way and let us get at it. But I don't think it's a sign that I'm getting old or anything. But I would just say this. I've changed my whole analysis. You see, when I look now at a man, and maybe he's brushing up against 80, and God saved him in his teens, and over 60 years later, his heart is still full of the things of the Lord. I tell you, now that I know a little bit more about life, and the pressures, and some of the problems, and some of the pitfalls, and things are not just as easy as they seem to me when I was in my middle teens. They're a little bit different when I see a man that has stayed the course for over 60 years. I lift my heart in gratitude to the God of grace, and there's a something there. You know, there's a man, I don't want you to inquire who this is. Don't be asking a thing about it. The night that I was baptized, there was another fellow baptized that night, another fellow in particular I'm thinking about. I was a good friend of his in those days. He's what I would call a 90 mile an hour Christian. When I was just about taking baby steps, he went down the motorway in the fast lane. He could preach when I could hardly read John 3. And he was taking meetings. I remember us going to a meeting one night, and there were maybe three there, or three brethren, I think, and that left plenty of space for me at that particular occasion. And I must have been, he said, what's wrong? Are you nervous or something? He had no problem preaching. 6 months. 6 months on the road, no problem whatsoever. This is just a cake. What's wrong with you? Well, I wonder what's wrong with him tonight. He's not in the race. Not in the race. It seemed to be all so much speed at the start. But it didn't go the distance. You know, there's nothing to be compared. This is what marks a life of control. The Christian life is a long haul. May God give us grace just to run with patience and with endurance. It was a man, you've heard about Bob Whelan, maybe. New York City Marathon, 1986. Bob Whelan, he finished the course. It took him 4 days, 19 hours, 48 minutes and 17 seconds. He was lost by a long score.
but he finished it. There were a lot of people dropped out, but Bob Whelan, he was right there. He was 19,417th. When you say, how did you expect us to have heard about Bob Whelan? There's nothing to talk about that. 17 years later, that should long since be forgotten of him. Not exactly. Bob Whelan's name, as many of you know, has become the name of a hero. You know what he did? In the Vietnam War, he had both his legs blown off. He ran the 26 miles, 385 yards of the marathon with pads on his hands. No legs, with pads on his hands, and with muscular arms, he launched his body forward. It took him over 4 days and 19 hours, but with such a handicap, he finished. And when Bob Whelan finished, after so much difficulty and endurance and stickability, he passed across the line with greater cheers than the man that was first. You know, I don't know all the details about the Christians here at Cullen. There are maybe some of you people, and you've been in the Vietnam War of circumstances. And in the battle of life, you've received handicap and scars and disabilities, and it's not easy, but you're still going. Dear brother and dear sister, whatever the difficulties may be, my little words are you tonight, and you're listening to someone who has had very few difficulties, so I know what I say will maybe not count for much, but my word to you tonight is keep going. Keep going. And do you see, when you cross the finishing line, and the pads on your hands, and the handicap, I tell you, the angels will step back, and they'll fold their wings if they have wings. And they'll say, there's a man who served God with stickability that we never knew. It will receive the acclaim of heaven. There's a race to be run with endurance. Now there are, I'm not going into the whole thing tonight, there are encumbrances that have to be laid aside. You know that, and there's sin that has to be laid aside. Weights. Well, I could talk about the weights. I don't think I should. That's not really going to another subject. I was going somewhere recently, and I didn't tell it to the folks here. I didn't want to do it again, but they were asking me how would they know in the airport. Well, I said, if you see the tall fellow with a slim figure and a good head of hair, I said, you'll know exactly that's him. That's him. Well, they stood. I think I walked past them about 4 times, and for some reason they didn't even notice me. I don't know. It's good to have this is the identification mark of a Christian that pleases God. They don't carry too much weight. They don't dabble in private sin. They don't get too much involved in career clutter. They don't get too much involved in hobby handicap. They don't get too much dragged down with business baggage. They keep the weight of materialism to a minimum. They judge sin. And I tell you, they can move in the race with stickability. Many of us are only making it more difficult for ourselves to go the distance, because we have gathered around ourselves so much excess baggage that we're only increasing that problem. And we not only have the endurance to be followed and the encumbrances to be laid aside, but thank God we have, of course, the great encouragement, looking off onto Jesus, keeping an eye fixed upon Him, clearly upon Him. You know, there's a difference. We've often told that the Lord Jesus, after all the list of great names in the previous chapter, that the Lord Jesus comes in as a very climax. We take a look at those men, but then we turn away from them all, and we turn away from other competitors, and we turn away from ourselves, and we look off onto Him, and He's the climax of it all. And that is very true. But I would say this, there's one area in which the Lord Jesus differs from those other men, the great men, the great women of Hebrews chapter 11, they were examples of faith. So is he. But he's more. He's not only an example of faith, he's the object of faith. Now he's an example of, there again, I don't like to be criticizing the good translation, we appreciate it, but I feel it's a very, very misleading thing again. Just puts us on a wrong track when we read in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2, is it, that looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Now you know, you've been told from your little children in Sunday school, as I was told, that the word "our" is not in the original. It's not telling us that Jesus is the author and finisher of our faith. It's just saying that he's the author and finisher of faith. You know, there was no one trusted God as implicitly as Christ then. Psalm 22, we could say, I was cast upon the earth, hanging in the gloom of Golgotha. He could say, Father, into thy heart I commend my spirit. From the beginning to the very end. You see, the root cause, brethren and sisters, of all our failure is self-confidence and human independence. We want to stand on our own feet. We want to do our own thing. We want to take our own way. We think that we are self-sufficient. The only perfect person who ever lived, he lived a life in which he trusted God for every moment. And he has taken faith to a higher level than it ever knew before. He's the pioneer and he's the perfecter of faith. Not of our faith. But faith has gone now and we see faith embodied in him seated on the right hand of the throne of God. And we keep our eye fixed upon him. I don't want to follow that through any further. But all I say is, dear brethren and sisters, keep going. Keep going the race. You know, I remember, I haven't been to America that much ever. I already referred to it. You think I'm never out of America. I'm not worried if I'm never back in it. But anyway, I remember being once in Boston and the Christian showed me the course for the marathon. I don't really know why. Maybe they thought it wouldn't do any harm. I had no interest really in it. But anyway, the Boston Marathon, it has a number of interesting points. And two of them are particularly well known. About the 11 or 12 mile mark, there's a place called Wellesley College. And all the students come out at Wellesley College, and that's just about the midpoint, the halfway point. That's a tough place, you know. Not too bad at the start. Everybody starts off with gusto. But when you're just getting about the halfway point, and you just wonder, you have as much in front of you as you have behind you. And it's just the period when the knees can get a bit wobbly, and you can begin to breathe heavily and all that. Well, the students are all there at Wellesley College, and they give everyone a powerful, hearty cheer. And they say that makes everybody go with extra zeal and energy from that point on. Well then, after a short distance after Wellesley College, there's about 8 miles. And in the 8 miles, you're steadily going up. But it's not a constant rise. You go up, and then there's a bit of a plateau. Then you go up again another bit on a plateau, and then up again, and you do that 5 times. And the very last rise is the toughest. It's the steepest. But you're already well exhausted by the time you get to the 5th rise. And I'm told that that's the place where the most dropouts take place. Because of that, it has been called Heartbreak Hill. But they tell me that if you can manage to negotiate Heartbreak Hill, you've made it. Because once you get over Heartbreak Hill, it's downhill all the way.
and it sweeps down in past the university campus, right down in yonder to the city centre, to the finishing line, and it's all plain sailing from Heartbreak Hill. And many people just give up. And if they could only keep going, they're just on the verge of victory. I was wondering, when I was thinking about this today, I was wondering, will I be speaking tonight in Cullen Gospel Hall to any dear Christian on Heartbreak Hill? Maybe there's some believer here, and you have claimed one or two, and you thought I wasn't doing too bad. But now the course of the Christian race has brought you to another incline that you never expected. Dear brother, dear sister, keep your eye on the conquering Christ. Don't allow yourself to cave in to discouragement or despair. Keep your trust in God. Run the race with stickability, because if you can just get over this hill, it'll maybe just be plain sailing right off, and a lot easier from here. But that's the point. The marathon of the Christian life, there's a race to be run. Now, I've spent too long on that because you know it's a favourite passage for preachers and all that, and you've heard it 1,326.5 times, and I don't want to say anything more about it. There's a rod to be recognised. You see, and then just immediately after that, where he's still speaking about this matter of experience, he and so forth. And he says, now I want to look upon your persecutions. I'm going to dignify them. And I'm going to see them as part of the training given to your spirits by a loving Father. Now he says, God has permitted these problems. And he said, the reason God has permitted these problems is because he's interested in your education, and he's interested in your advancement. Now this brings us into a very sensitive area of Christian experience. Indeed, I would say one of the biggest problems in the world is the problem of human suffering. That's a problem in a global sense for the whole of humanity. The problem resolves itself into this. If God is good, why does he not stop evil? Well, you say, is he able to stop it? Well, oh yes, sure, God could stop all the earthquakes. God could stop all the hurricanes. And God could stop all the bank robberies. And God could stop all the mugging. Certainly he could stop it. You say, what? You mean to tell me that the God that you believe in is able to stop all the suffering? Yes. He's able. Well, if he doesn't do it, he mustn't be loving. If he can do it and he doesn't do it, he mustn't be a very kind God. To sit upon his throne when he can stop all this and he just watches people languish in agony. So you're up against a dilemma. He's either less than all powerful, or else he's less than all good. But then, that problem that I'm speaking about in a general sense, it's compounded, not just by the suffering of humanity in general, but then what about the suffering of God's own children? Why does he allow his own people to suffer? Well, you say, is he not a loving Father? He tells us here actually that this discipline that I'm speaking about is one of the proofs of his love. It's one of the proofs of their sonship. There's a double demonstration. His love as a father, their position as sons. And there are two degrees of this education. There's chastening and there's scourging. I take it that scourging is a wee bit more severe than chastening. Scourging can involve the rod. And then there's a double design. I'm going through this very quickly. There's a double design in all this experience. He says, God allows this, first of all, that you people might be partakers of his holiness, and that in your life it may yield the peaceable fruits of righteousness He says he wants you to have his nature, and he also wants you to express his character, holiness and righteousness. And he said he's training your spirit. You know, that's a very important aspect of the training of a controlled and a disciplined life. The father of spirits. We maybe don't think about that. I've gone to believers in hospital many a time. I've heard a little bit about their story. And in my own unbelief, I have said to myself, if I go here, I'll find somebody very badly disturbed, distraught with all these circumstances. And sometimes when I go into the hospital ward and see some of those believers who have had multiple trauma in their life, I don't be talking to them 2 minutes until I can see a maturity and a mellowness in their spirit. Not a trace of bitterness. Not a trace of resentment. And all the difficulties in their family, in their work, in flying, and even in their bodies, it seems to have developed their spirit. That's why God is called in this passage the Father of Spirits. And it has developed the interior. The interior of their being. You see, I feel, brethren and sisters, that we are not enough concerned about the growth of our inside. The inside of our personality. That's what God is concerned. That's why he allows some of these apparently inexplicable sufferings. They're not always. They're not always correction for sin. And we don't want to be setting ourselves up as God to decide which is which. Not always correction for sin. They can just be the cultivation of character. And for the improvement of character. And now, if I'm going to be well pleasing to God, oh, he says you can faint. And he says you can despise it. You can just shrug it off and say, ah, you're too bad. Just these things happen. I don't care. That's just despising it. Or you can faint and become bitter and resentful. That's fainting. Or he says you can be exercised about it. And he says you can be subject. Subjection. This is not endurance. The race to be run was endurance. This is the rod to be respected. And this is exercise. And it's in the spiritual exercise that I will cultivate that development. I've just taken a little note here of one or two events. John G. Patton, fellow Scotsman with yourselves, as you know, he left this country in 1858, married in March 1858. In April he sailed away to the New Hebrides in the Pacific Sea, South Pacific. One year later, in the month of March, after giving birth to her first child, his wife took a very serious fever and she died. He had a single-handed funeral. He buried her alone. And as well as being his hope in God, his hope was in the little infant that remained. 3 weeks later, the infant died. And this is what John G. Patton wrote. He said, but for Christ, or but for Jesus, I'd have gone mad and died beside that lonely grave. The two people whom he loved best on earth, or with whom his heart's affections were entwined, were there. He later said that what really sustained him was that in his wife's few days of final illness, this is what she said to some of the friends who came to see her. They expected to find a woman left Scotland, traveled to the other side of the earth in days when travel were difficult. God let them down now with illness and poverty and loneliness. They expected to find a woman who would be bitter and would be resentful of what God was permitting. This is what she told them.
She said, I do not regret leaving home and friends. If I had to do it over again, I would do it with more pleasure. Yes, with all my heart. Now, I don't know what you Christians think, but I think from that very simple little cottage in the islands of the South Pacific, there was a fragrance went up to heaven from the spirit of that young woman who was dying, and from her husband who worshipped God and served God and carried on. Sarah Edwards, you've often heard about the famous Jonathan Edwards. He died when he was 58. Quite a few difficulties, but he had gone actually just to become a president of an organization. When he was away, he received some kind of inoculation for chicken pox, and he took the thing, and he died unexpectedly. His wife got the news back, thinking she would hear about her husband as a new president. She got the word back that he had gone to be with Christ. She couldn't understand it. He left her with 10 children. This is what she wrote to her oldest daughter, Elizabeth. She said, my very dear child, what shall I say? A holy and a good God has covered us with a dark cloud. Oh, that we may kiss the rod and lay our hands upon our mouth. The Lord has done it. He has made me adore his goodness that we had your father for so long. He is now gone. But my God lives, and he has my heart. Oh, what a legacy my husband and your father has left us. We are all given to God, and there I am, and hope to be, your affectionate mother, Sarah Edwards. Imagine, she said, let us kiss the rod. That's spirit, that's a controlled life. That's a life that's well pleasing to God. There's a race to be run. There's a rod to be recognized. A race to be won with endurance. A rod to be recognized with exercise. There's a road to be traveled. You look at those following verses very, very quickly now, and I'll just terminate in a second. Look at verse number 12, for example. Lift up the hands which hang down, the feeble knees. Verse 13, make straight paths for your feet. Verse 14, follow peace with all men. Now he says there's a road that we need to travel if we're going to please God. I've called this road in my meditations the highway of holiness. He says, follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Now that word follow, as many of you may know, is a very strong word. It's actually the verb that is constantly used in the New Testament for persecution. Persecute. Now, it doesn't mean that here. But it's a word that indicates energy and intensity. It's the very word that the Apostle Paul says, I press toward the mark. Now he says, press after holiness. Follow, pursue. Press after peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see. And he said, if you're going to follow that highway of holiness, you'll need to make straight paths for your feet. You know, dear brethren and sisters, we're living in a very corrupt world. And all I'll say because of the time, holiness and practical sanctification is not something that comes easily. It has to be followed. It has to be pursued. I look upon younger folks, a few of them here tonight, we're glad to see you. And I don't want to embarrass anyone, but I'll say this. I hope that you read no book and that you visit no website that is a compromise to holiness. Do you see when you go into that little room and you shut the door, and there's a screen and a keyboard and a telephone line there, and a mouse in your right hand, I would say make straight paths for your feet and for your hand. Because there could be channeled onto that screen material that would lead to your spiritual undoing and to the devastation of your testimony.
Oh, you say, but I like a wee bit of private viewing. If you take a little bit of private viewing that is illicit and unclean, you're beginning to give titbits to a monster that can never be satisfied. And he'd always be looking more. Pursue holiness. Follow it with a passion. Make straight paths for your feet. Don't be going into any alleys. Don't be going round any crooked bends. He says there's a highway to holiness, and if you're going to live a life that's pleasing to God, you'll have to control your movements within the hedges of that highway. Pursue holiness. There's a road to be travelled, and of course it's the best road. And it's not only the highway of holiness, but it's the highway of happiness. Because wherever you have a holy life in fellowship with God, it will have its compensating joys. A race to be run, a road to be recognized, a road to be traveled. I want to think about a route to be watched. I'm really speeding up now. For example, in verse number 15, he says, looking diligently, keep an eye out, watch carefully, lest any fail, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, lest there be any fornicator. You can see those three dangers. I'm just going to mention the root of bitterness. I know apostasy. I know that. In the context. The root of bitterness is a quotation from Deuteronomy 28, is it? And the root of bitterness was a person in the nation who began to worship false gods. And God described that person as a root of bitterness because such a person could have a pernicious influence upon others. And God said, that's a poisonous plant that can infect other members of the holy congregation. And he says, that person needs to be dealt with. So the root of bitterness in an Old Testament context was a person who apostatized and went back to idolatry and so on. I think there's a very similar background here. The root of bitterness is an apostate. But nevertheless, just leaving that, application now. You know, if our lives are going to please God, you need to watch a root of bitterness. There's a little thing I have noticed, and I've already hinted at it. For some reason or other, there are some dear Christians, and after a while, and taking into account what I've already said about the ups and downs and the hardships and the heights and the hollows of the Christian pathway, taking into account with that, you can understand why it is to a certain extent. But there are some believers, and they seem to get a chip on their shoulder. And their mind becomes a memory bank for old gripes and old grudges. And they're bitter, and they're critical, and they're jaundiced, and they're hard to live with, and everybody's wrong, and everybody's out of step, and they just become completely withered and wizened in their whole spiritual experience. Now, I need to watch, because as soon as I would detect that root of bitterness, that's a plant that it can grow. Somebody snubs me. Or they're going to have a conference and they don't ask me to speak. And that insult or that snub, or somebody doesn't shake hands with me, that just drops a seed into my heart. And then, of course, I water it a wee bit with the tears of self-pity. Oh, dear, poor me. And once I have watered it with the tears of self-pity, this seed, it sprouts up with the poisonous plant of bitterness, and it poisons me. And it has, this plant actually, it has big roots, and it has choppy long thorns. And it poisons me, and it hurts everybody that comes into contact with me. You know what I need to do? As soon as I see that plant just beginning to peep up the first little green leaf, I need to take the trial of exercise in the presence of God, and dig down deep into the cavity of my heart, and hurt myself as I pierce through the soil,
until the root is out.
Because if I'm going to live a life that pleases God, there's not only a race to be run, and a road to be recognized, and a road to be traveled, there's a route to be avoided. I was going to speak about a revelation to be embraced. It's not Mount Sinai, it's Mount Zion. All the brilliance of Mount Zion, with its grace and its approachability and its accessibility, with its righteousness, with its royalty, with all the advantages of Mount Zion, God has revealed himself in this dispensation with an unparalleled clarity and a finality. Now, says the writer, he says, bask in the clear light of Mount Zion. And he said, embrace the fullness of that revelation. And he said, if you live in the new dispensation, the old is gone. The sanctions and the system of Sinai, they are both a thing of the past. The new regime of Zion has already commenced. He said, you live in the full blaze of the unfading light of that new revelation, and don't be going back to the old. In fact, some of these people would have thought, if we go back to the old, we're going to be real Jacobs. He says, I tell you, if you go back to the old, you're nothing but Esau's. You're nothing but Esau's. A profane, I'll not go into that, a profane and just that lack of appreciation of the value of eternal things, and profane person and fornicator like Esau. No, he says, don't be going back. He says, live and embrace this full revelation. Now, just finally, he says there's a reverence to be expressed. I'm skipping out a little bit. I was going to talk about a removal to be anticipated. He says the whole thing's going to move. God's going to shake the whole fabric of this creation. Don't be getting captivated by materialism. He says, you people have got spiritual realities that will never change. You know, brothers and sisters, it's great to know that when the very fabric of this universe has disintegrated, that our relationship with God will be just as strong as it ever was. It will not, when the very ground beneath, that is now beneath our feet, the very ground beneath our feet, and these rocks and these coastlands and the highlands and everything, when those things have begun to disappear, and everything that we have known, the houses that we have lived in, the cars that we have driven, and the roads that we have travelled, everything that we have known of a material nature is passing away. What we enjoy tonight is spiritual reality, and our relationship with God will be just the same. It can never, now he says, get a good hold on what will never move. And he said, don't become fascinated with the things that are going to all be taken away. He says, anticipate that. But finally, the seventh thing in the chapter is a reverence to be expressed. Now he says, there's one thing you have, a very close relationship with God. He has told us in this chapter that God is the Father of spirits, and he's dealing with us as Son. And he has told us about some of the privileges of Mount Zion. Now he says, yes, he says, you people have a new relationship with God. But he said, I don't want you to have sentimental thoughts about God. Now he says, if you're going to serve him, after all that he has been and all that he has done and all that he has promised for the future, he said, if you want to serve him, he said, that's good. Serve him, he said, with energy, and serve him with enthusiasm, and serve him so that you'll please him. But he says, make sure that you do it with reverence and with godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. You know, if there's anything, dear brothers and sisters, just before I pray, if there's anything that I feel we are maybe slightly, the land has lost it, the nation has lost it, and I wonder, sometimes in my wanderings, I just have a little suspicion that we are beginning to lose a sense of the holiness and the greatness of God. You know, people talk about the man above. I absolutely detest that statement. God is not the man above. I heard Tiger Woods the other day, and he wastes his time knocking a wee white ball around the golf courses of this world.
And when he hit some of his big scores, oh, I said, the big guy in the sky, help me. God is our Father. But remember, he's still a consuming fire. We can't take liberties. Everything in our age now has to be flexi. Some of you people have even flexi hours. I have flexi hours of preaching too. So I don't want to say, flexi, flexi hours. Everything's flexi. Flexi hours. He just don't, in at 8 o'clock. Oh no, give us a bit of a common cold. I can make the half 8 and so on and so on. And we want, you stop at 5. No, we want to stop early one day and we'll work on a bit the next day and we'll stop early and we'll get a couple of days. Flexi hours, casual dress. Casual meeting. Let us have grace that we might serve him acceptably with reverence and with godly fear. A race to be run. A road to be recognized. A road of holiness to be traveled. A route of bitterness to be pulled on. A revelation of Zion to be embraced. A removal of all material things to be anticipated. And a reverence to be expressed. If we have those seven things of Hebrews 12 in our lives, I can guarantee you that my life and your life will be a controlled life. And it will definitely please God. He's very easy to please. But he's hard to satisfy. May God make us busy so that we may reach a higher standard, shall we pray?